Welcome to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
Morena, everyone, and you are listening to Radio 191 FM, and this is the R1 News with Sinéna. Ko Sinéna aho.
Ko Scott aho.
Coming up on the program, E Tēnei Rā, we speak to the president of Aotearoa's Legal Workers Union, who have just released their 2021 Employment Information Report on the impact of the workload to workers' mental health. News reporter Scott Favell spoke with Otago University students about the policy changes to vaccine passes and how it is affecting their everyday life.
Later, we spoke to Marcelo Rodriguez Ferrer of the Otago Law Faculty about Dunedin City Councillor Lee Vandervies judicially reviewing the infamous parking ticket saga in the Court of Appeal. We have Professor Kurt Krause, a virologist at the University of Otago, about the new RNA technology to cure HIV going to trial. Plus, the news bulletin and weather coming up this hour. First, here's Bank on R1 News. It is 5 minutes past 11 and you are listening to R1 News. Coming up, we are speaking with Spokes Dunedin about the portrayal of cycling accidents in the media. But first, we have Bonnie with the bulletin.
This is the news on Radio 191 FM.
Kia ora koutou, this is your R1 News bulletin. It's 11:05 AM. Ko Bonnie aho. Rangatira activist and legal scholar Moana Jackson has died. Jackson of Ngāti Kahungunu and Ngāti Porou is the author of the groundbreaking 1980s report into Māori in the criminal justice system and contributed to the drafting of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Jackson is widely regarded as one of the most important constitutional thinkers in Aotearoa's history. Mue mai rā e te rangatira. A new report shows that New Zealand has the highest rate of melanoma diagnoses and melanoma deaths in the world. In a dermatology report published this morning, it was revealed New Zealand has continued its worrying trends of serious skin cancer, with rates sometimes double that of other OECD countries. Melanoma cancer is the third most common cancer diagnosis in the country. Cancer Society co-medical president Dr. Kate Gregory advises that melanoma are highly curable if caught in the early stages, but warns that a high level of vigilance is needed to monitor changes in your own skin. The minimum wage is set to increase tomorrow to $21.20, up from $20. This comes as part of a routine increase policy under the Labor government, with minimum wages being steadily increased annually from $16.50 at the beginning of their first term. Minister for Workplace Relations Michael Wood said for a full-time minimum wage worker, this increase represents almost another $2,500 annually. The ACT Party has recently called for a three-year moratorium on minimum wage increases as part of a fleet of new social policies in response to dwindling polling numbers. The ACT Party is also pledging to remove increased sick leave allowances and scrap Matariki as a public holiday. That's the news. Now for weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
I tēnei rā, in Otsipōti we have a high of 20 degrees, a low of 10 overnight, some possible drizzle into the afternoon and evening. Tomorrow, Friday, we have a high of 14 degrees, rain throughout the day, and a low of 8 overnight. And that's your weather.
Kia ora, Bonnie. Up next on the show, we are speaking with Spokes Dunedin Committee member Kitty Creswell-Riol about how the media portrays incidents involving drivers and cyclists. In the meantime, here's a song, Chelsea Jade with Optimist. You are listening to R1 News.
When your baby and I cry, randomly fade, like my good sides just facing a bad line, tell you where I sign.
You're listening to R1 News. Cycling is an increasingly popular, accessible and environmentally friendly way to get from A to B, and cyclists are road users like any automobile. However, their rights as road users are increasingly downplayed by media outlets when they report on vehicles impacting cyclists. Headlines often read as cyclists being hit by cars rather than by drivers, downplaying the role of human error in these roading accidents. Here with us now is Kitty Cresswell-Riol from Spokes Dunedin, a local cycling advocacy group. Kia ora, Kitty.
Kia ora.
Cycling is more popular than ever for recreation and commuting, but at the same time, drivers' aggression towards cyclists has only gotten worse. The Ministry of Transport reported 11 cyclists were killed in vehicle collisions last year. Do you think the cycling boom has changed attitudes towards and about cyclists on the road?
Wait, say that again?
Do you think that the cycling boom has changed attitudes towards and about cyclists on the road?
Definitely. I mean, the more cyclists there are on the road, the more safer it's going to be for everybody. And I think, is that what you mean? Like, definitely the attitudes will change. It's kind of a catch-22 in regard to when there's less cyclists on the road, then it's more unsafe for other cyclists. But we need a kind of a safe environment in order for more cyclists to get onto the road at the same time.
So where have you seen kind of negative attitudes towards cyclists come from? Where do they stem from?
It's definitely, as you're saying, in the media, there's a lot of victim-blaming language that is used in reporting, and also a lack of positive cycling stories. And that kind of perpetuates kind of the myths around cycling, which leads to a lot of antagonism, like that cyclists aren't legitimate road users, for instance, or that the roads belong to drivers because they pay road tax, which isn't actually a thing in itself. And also the lack of political will in creating a cycling culture and promoting cycling as a legitimate form of transport also promotes that as well.
So in your view, this is related to why these cycling incidents are being portrayed as accidents caused by cars as opposed to being caused by, you know, drivers and people.
Yeah, I mean, that's just something that continues in the media. I mean, there's so much research out there saying, as you were saying before, that it's kind of, like, for example, the incident rather than accident, which fails to convey that someone is at fault, avoids the fact that there was any responsibility, and the same idea with the idea of the saying car or truck instead of driver is very passive, and it fails to address who actually caused the incident. And that's just to do with the fact that we live in a very auto-centric society, because at the same time, while the driver is exonerated, the victim is blamed. So a lot of focus is placed on what was the cyclist wearing? Were they wearing high vis? Were they wearing a helmet? Were they wearing earbuds? And then it fails to look at the wider structural issues that are at play. Because, I mean, cyclists and pedestrian deaths as well are not isolated incidents. They're due to wider systemic issues, which are supported by this toxic victim-blaming culture, which is perpetuated in the media.
So what kind of changes do you think we need to see to the system in order to actually improve the outcomes for cyclists?
Well, I mean, it kind of goes back to this idea that cycling is seen as unsafe, when actually cycling is really safe. It's the environment that's unsafe, and by the environment that includes obviously the physical infrastructure, but also driver behavior and also legislation. So in order to create a safe cycling environment, we'd have to look at creating a cycling network, at protected cycleways, doing things like enforcing 30k speed limits in the city centers, as they've done in Auckland actually, and also establishing laws that presume liability for motorists, which is something they've done in Holland, and getting rid of things like compulsory helmet law, which again puts onus on the cyclist.
So we are seeing a lot of these new cycleways kind of popping up all over the country, and obviously that comes with a lot of backlash from car users. Do you think these attitudes are getting in the way of government groups funding further and safer cycling infrastructure?
I think in a way it might be the other way around, that unless we kind of change this kind of auto-centric funding that we have, that needs to go first, I would argue. We need that political will to kind of then push people to put things in place to make this safer environment and get people to see that it does make sense.
Cool. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Kitty.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Kitty Creswell-Riol of Spokes Dunedin speaking to the issues about the portrayal of cycling injuries in media. Coming up, we have the president of Aotearoa's Legal Workers Union, Isabella Lehen-Iken, speaking to the Employment Information Report released earlier this month about the effects of high workload on mental health. First, here's a song, Double Double, with Big Mike featuring Polly Hill and LVJ.
I love the pop shots, mostly hella bowl. Lemon lime, caviar, spread, ice, balloon, roll.
Sights on the front row, with the eyes closed underneath blindfolds to remain on a cool.
I think they got too comfortable. Feet up and they're inflatable.
Yeah, I'ma call him Big Michael, cause I got beef right now with this one dude named Michael.
And I thought it sound cool. Got never-ending hollow-pointed rounds that's full of doo-doo. You better hope you're fool.
I'm a foodie.
Cause all my bars are stupid. I'll make stupid good look. Doodle rap like some coloring books. Over the line and I oop. When calling them out in the hood. Keep them on the back foot. Traveling back hard and backwards. I smoke them out backwards.
Back and forth like a tennis match. On all fours like a pup or a house beat. I see you dipping in the kitchen, how a mouse be. Sipping on cheap pale ales that you got for free. Now who you connect that you're scooping? I heard your boy Barry's moving boxes for Coopers. Now that don't impress me, Mike. Honestly, your baggage is bad on my back and my psyche. Like me, you ain't getting feisty. Timid soft boy tendencies seem kinda likely now. You don't wanna fight me. Just try and see yourself in the past, future, and the present. Don't take offense now. You're the one that said it. Trying to credit me to the level of a peasant. I ain't trying to sever you, so you might as well forget it. You can keep uploading dick pics onto Reddit.
Why did you hide anymore?
We don't need you.
We don't need you anymore.
We don't need
you.
What it take to change a light bulb. One to climb the ladder, one to quote the Bible. One for the revival of some cultural denial. One for the false idols and one to break the cycle. But don't hold your breath, hold your own. Know your strength, play your role. And like Drake sipped who, you better know yourself. Get them good views for when the posers do expose themselves. Wow, like they're modeling tidy whiteys. I might be hikey, calling out these Mikeys. Don't mic me, and not another white collar. Pseudo scholar, text my dollar man. If you follow, holler then. Look, this is really about to go down. And when it does, you better come correct. Just like a pronoun, pronoun. See, I've been around a block or two. Seasons change, sagas don't like we're watching Doctor Who.
Way back, receiving bald cap. Me and Peggy head strap, what LeBron used to have. You a different kind of on the red, on the hat. Lay your left red tracks on your pants. Indiana Jones, man. Yeah, you're both age bands. Of the times you would have said, yet you still repeat the act, repeat the act. Like every episode of Friends, you're still playing. Back to back, back to back, back to back. Ass to ass.
Why you keep running back, same track? In your bed, got in memory lapsed, got them all guessed.
Well, I've seen that, I don't need that. You can keep that, but you're attached. The pain on my back. I got Draymond's backpack, messing with my step back. I'm getting pretty tired of carrying your ass.
We don't need.
We don't need you.
It is 11:21 a.m. and you are listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. Coming up, we have news reporter Scott Favell with the student take on the policy change to vaccine passes.
Just like that one mate in high school, the Omicron wave has peaked, according to last Wednesday's COVID-19 media conference. Accordingly, the government is shifting its focus to the future, both near and far. When she spoke last Wednesday, the Prime Minister captured the sentiment of these changes, with the same phrase many are using worldwide to capture the same sentiment.
the new normal.
From Monday, the vaccine pass we have long relied on for access to the world at large will no longer be mandated, although businesses will be able to choose whether or not their patrons will still need them. On a local front, it is worth pointing out that the southern region has not yet reached its peak. Southern DHB modelling continues to predict a rise in cases around the Otago Southland region and is stressing to the public not to get complacent. Wearing a mask is still going to be an important part of daily life. Even as we start to adjust, the Prime Minister reminds us that in the event of a new variant, these services will become essential again. There is opposition across the political spectrum to these changes. National COVID-19 spokesperson Chris Bishop welcomes the changes, but calls for simplification of the traffic light system, while ACT leader David Seymour felt more strongly about their redundancy.
Hospitality has been decimated. Changing the crowd size limit to 200 makes little difference to most venues. Stopping people moving between tables just absolutely kills the buzz. However, the way the government is dragging it out seems to be driven more and more by politics than public health.
Newly minted Green Party COVID-19 spokesperson Tiano Tuiono offered the opposite opinion, however. While his party opposes the COVID changes, like ACT, the Greens believe that we need far stronger protections. Among them, Tuiono calls for a school-based vaccination program and free N95 masks for everyone. But what do the people on the ground think about these changes? Well, for some of the students that R1 News talked to, caution is still a top priority. A lot of the Dunedin Omicron cases can be credited to parties and other social events early on in the year, so easing of the restrictions came as a relief to one student trying to play host.
Obviously, would have had to instruct a force limit if these mandates or these new rules didn't come out. But now with the new rules, you know, we have a lot more freedom to work with. Yeah, I guess we the new 100, 200 person limit, that's a big factor in like this whole thing going ahead, I think.
Another amateur party planner we spoke to echoed this opinion.
It was a bit relieving because as soon as the 12 a.m. Would strike, we would be able to hold as many people outdoors as we could and then 200 people inside. But it definitely helped with the situation. We had less to manage and like less responsibilities fall on us in case anything would have gone sideways, you know.
Not all students are as relieved, however. One student employed in the hospitality sector feels the risk isn't worth the reward.
That's a little bit concerning. Basically, any increase in likelihood of bringing COVID into the workplace is concerning because it just increases my chance of getting it. And I don't think it's going to affect the business all that much, so I think it's just a bit unnecessary.
Regardless of their perspective, students will have to confront the risk, as the university has approved the return of most lectures to in-person status. Only the largest lectures will remain online at alert level red, and a transition to orange will see all lectures back and face-to-face. This move doesn't benefit everyone. The Otago Disabled Students Association points out that although disabled people were consulted over mandate provisions for hospitals, it fails to recognise that this consultation reflects an institutionalised view of disability and that disabled people live in the wider community. For them, these changes undermine the protection that the mandates were designed to provide and risks faster spread, especially among the immunocompromised. The weakening of mandates means that for those receiving home care, not even home is safe. ODSA asks fellow students to be hypervigilant about stopping the virus with hygiene, masks, and social distancing, and to display allyship for the disabled community by advocating for hybrid lectures that ensure both safety and accessibility for all. So what can we take from this? Well, relief and caution aren't mutually exclusive. These changes make significant concessions for those who feel comfortable moving past vaccine passes and contact tracing, while allowing the cautious to stick with what has worked. We're a step closer to the future, and the new normal that comes with it. But what that new normal looks like isn't the same for everyone.
You're listening to R1 News. Up next, Sinéad will be interviewing Aotearoa Legal Workers Union President Isabella Leanhin-Ikan. But first, it's El Hotel with Astronaut.
Have you
gonna take? Do you take the right way down when you are new? And have you ever noticed? 'Cause I still do. If it's the same old same, try something new. But it's about time we grew up. And we both know well enough, 'cause it's a real far way to go. But I used to dream of being a scientist, to wear a white coat and dig up dinosaurs and plan it my way. It's my school play. And I used to dream of being an astronaut to fly sky high, and you'd be my passenger to planets far away. It's my school play.
You are listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. The Aotearoa Legal Workers Union has just released their employment information report that finds that lawyers' mental health continues to be greatly impacted due to high workload and subject matter of the profession. Bullying by senior staff was frequently mentioned throughout the report as being one of the predominant causes of poor mental health. We are joined by the president of Aotearoa Legal Workers Union, Isabella Lehan-Aiken, to talk to us about the report, what the union and what the union aims to do. Welcome to the show, Isabella.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Firstly, the legal workforce is one of the oldest in the country, yet it has not yet been it's just now been unionised. Why now?
Yeah, it is actually a really interesting thing. Often lawyers are compared to other professionals like doctors or engineers or teachers who are really well unionised. And it's interesting that lawyers are only now in Aotearoa becoming unionised in the same fashion. The reason why ALWU, or the Aotearoa Legal Workers Union, was established was in response, and I'm sure listeners can recall this, the publication of some news in 2018 that there was terrible sexual assault at one of New Zealand's premier law firms, and that shone light onto cultural issues within the legal profession around misuse of power that was unfortunately and sadly and grossly manifesting itself in the sexual assault of junior lawyers by often senior partners. And so in response to that, junior lawyers organized themselves and decided that establishing a union was one of the best and most tried ways of recalibrating power within a workplace, and to actually give power and legitimacy to employees to say, hey, the health and safety practices of this workplace are unacceptable, the pay of this workplace is unacceptable, and for there to be a legal framework for which they can follow in order to remedy and essentially retain and keep and grow the power of workers.
Yes, and so are lawyers signing up to this union, and how hard is it to unionise a workforce that has a reputation for being so-called well-off?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think in response to ALWU establishing, we've had really great membership. Mm-hmm. We've got about 1,000 members on our list, and they are in, some of them are students, some of them are, most of them work at private law firms, and some also in the public sector. Mainly our membership is young lawyers, like junior lawyers up till about 5 years post-qualification experience, and with about 5 years post-qualification experience, sorry. And I think that your second point around how hard has it been to establish the culture of unionism, I think this is a really interesting point because largely people of a similar age to me, I'm in my mid-20s, haven't grown up with unions being a cultural institution that we're really familiar with. And that's because the 1990 suite of reforms to our Employment Relations Act has essentially reduced the power of unions. And that has meant that with the wave of voluntary union membership has meant that, you know, now we're dealing with a situation in Aotearoa that many people aren't member of unions, and they actually are not entirely sure what unions do or the power that unions can hold in a collective sense. And so not only are we having to establish the role of a union within the legal workforce, but a lot of the work that we do is actually educating people about what unions are and what power they hold, and discussing the successes that unions have had in the past and still today, and that they are a very relevant institution that people should subscribe to and join and be a part of. You know, if we can look at things around like pay equity and the changes that the benefits that women have had due to union membership, and all of the changes recently, if fair pay agreements were just announced yesterday, you know, power of workers, that's the power of unions, and we need to tell that story better so that young people can recognise that and join up.
Yeah, no, awesome. And so the 2021 Employment Information Report that was based on a survey that went out to all union members had an overwhelmingly high 83% of people that stated that their mental health had suffered due to workplace pressures. And some union members had stated that they were experiencing burnout and suffering from anxiety and stress. Have you seen this increase of your members coming to you with the same concerns over the last few years?
Yeah, I don't think that we've necessarily, so the report, just to clarify, went out to all lawyers. So all, not only ALWU members could complete the survey. So it went out to lawyers regardless of whether they're an ALWU member. And so the interesting thing is, I think, with the mental health stuff is that we haven't, like, that has been a really key issue that has come up in the last three reports that we've done. And it comes up in the individual advocacy, so part of the work that ALWU does is provide individual advocacy to people, and often that is around breaches of health and safety obligations in relation to people's mental well-being. So it's definitely an issue that continues to come up. I think that globally, with, you know, the stresses of the world and COVID, we've seen a heightened, and you know, there's lots of evidence to suggest this, heightened pressures that put greater pressure on people's well-being. But I think that there's a large culture of people being exploited in legal workplaces, and so the global situation has only exacerbated and brought that stuff to light. It hasn't created it.
Yes, yeah, and I guess for, we are both students here, and for new law graduates coming into the workforce, do you feel that entering this work scene now that they are going to be more aware of these workplace issues?
Yeah, I think that for, like, if I could give advice to people who are currently students and who are going into the workplace, it would be make sure you read reports like this, whether you're in the legal profession or not, and actually think about where you want to work for the alignment that it has with your values. So you don't want to go into a place where you're exploited and you spend every night, you know, staying up late doing the work. You actually want to have a good life. You want to have a good job, but you also want to do other things outside of your work. And asking employers hard questions about how they are addressing the issues that have come to light in the report is actually a really important way, A, of holding employers accountable, and also B, determining whether it's a place that you want to work. You know,
yeah.
Although that there are lots of law firms that have been shown in this report to not necessarily have good practices around pay or not have good practices around health and safety, there are legal workplaces that are really, you know, taking control of this and are reshaping the narrative, and they should also be acknowledged for their work. But also the other thing I'd say is that the public sector lawyers have traditionally, in this report, received higher remuneration than private sector lawyers, especially junior lawyers. And what this report has shown is that that has shifted as a result, which we can assume is the result of the public sector pay freeze, which has meant that the salaries of public sector workers hasn't increased. And we think that there's also an argument here that lawyers need to put pressure, especially those working in the public sector, on the public sector, on the state, to actually provide good working conditions, because they are the ones that set the tone and set the bar for how other private law firms can then respond. And it is unacceptable that they've capped salaries at a time when living costs are going through the roof.
Yeah, no, definitely. And for the listeners out there, how can they contact you and the union to get in touch?
Yeah, our website is lwu.org.nz, and you're welcome to go on there and sign up. You're also welcome to contact us through any social media, Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. But yeah, if you have any questions about the report or about LWU, and if you're a student, it's free to join. And if you earn over $50K, it's $50 a year. So we're trying to really make it an accessible way for people to receive the support and solidarity that a union provides.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Isabella.
Thanks for having me.
That was the president of Aotearoa's Legal Workers Union. And coming up, we have Lime Cordial with Screw Loose. You are listening to R1 News here on Radio 1.
Arise from anybody who would care. You hate it, you love it, you'd fake your f***ing death. Run that out of spanks when you finally get caught. Turn it into a little argument, that's not what you've been taught. You don't do what your mama ever says. You never stay inside and refuse to go to bed. Climbing out the window of your bedroom, see you later. To the people of the night, gonna lie, sick of paper. This magical abyss, you somehow think you're fine. Your mind, it all goes straight to you. Nothing left to lose. This confidence, it'll feel you when you're drowning.
you got us kudos.
You're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1 at 17 minutes to 12. Sorry. If you have any comments on the stories we've talked about so far, you can always text on 0212-RADIO-1. That's 0212-272-3461. Coming up, we have Sinana with Professor Kurt Krause about the new RNA technology going to trial which targets HIV virus. But first, last week, Councillor Lee Vandervies took his beef with the Dunedin City Council to the Court of Appeal almost 3 years after the inciting incident. He received a $12 parking ticket in 2019 after failing to notice that his car park was limited to 30 minutes and overstaying. He complained about this to council staff, who then lodged a complaint about him to council, saying his behaviour was inappropriate, and Vandervies ultimately received a written censure from the CEO of the council. He has since racked up tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees, taking his case to the High Court, where he was denied, and now finally to the Court of Appeal. R1 News Manager Bonnie Harrison spoke to Senior Lecturer from the Faculty of Law, Marcelo Rodriguez Ferrer.
Thanks for joining us, Marcelo.
Pleasure to be here, Bonnie.
So we all know the story about the $12 parking ticket. It's been in the news for almost 3 years now. The media loves getting a little kick out of Vandervies. He never stops. In this long legal battle that he has fought to somehow vindicate this quite silly, small action, I wonder if you can shed a bit of light about what the judicial review that he's taking to the Court of Appeal actually concerns. What action is he focusing on here?
So he's focusing essentially on the process that was taken by the Dunedin City Council in processing not only his complaint against the staff member who processed his complaint against the parking ticket, but also the staff member's complaint against his behaviour when he was complaining about the parking ticket itself. Court for the High Court and now for the Court of Appeal was really whether or not that process was fair.
Right, so that's what judicial review does. This isn't about whether the parking ticket was legitimate. This is about a use of public power.
Yeah, so this has actually nothing to do with the parking ticket, really, which is a good thing because it's a pretty small amount. But it's actually about the process for processing the complaint that he made against the council and the council's complaint against him. Judicial review is basically trying to ensure that those who wield public power do so legally. We understand that sort of public power can be abused. We can understand that sort of it's really important to ensure that the court or the judiciary restricts government action and ensures that it's being exercised in a way that is appropriate and fair and legal. And one of those ways to restrict the power is to ensure that any process that's undertaken by a public authority is a fair one. So in this instance, there was an allegation that Mr. Vandervies had breached the Dunedin City Council's code of conduct that applies to particular councillors. And in determining whether or not he had breached the code of conduct and leading to a censure of Mr. Vandervies, there was a process that was followed, and he's arguing that that process was unfair.
And that code of conduct is public power being exercised.
Yeah, essentially it's ensuring that the DCC, in sort of restricting elected members, ensuring that they are complying with the appropriate standards that would be becoming of a councillor. It's essentially to ensure that councillors aren't abusing their power as elected councillors. And no, he's essentially sort of the exercise of public power here is the Dunedin City Council's censuring of Lee Vandervies, and the process that led to that censure was determining whether or not he breached a code of conduct. And so, yeah, that's an exercise of public power. Why? Because the Dunedin City Council is a public authority, and they're exercising power that affects Lee Vandervies and his rights and status. And on that basis, we consider that to be an exercise of public power and one that we'd want to make sure is as fair as possible.
And that public power that the council has to create a code of conduct, mm-hmm. that comes from
statute.
Where?
Yeah. So they've actually required under the Local Government Act 2002, isn't this fun, everybody, to have a code of conduct that applies to councillors, yeah.
And council staff or just councillors?
In this particular instance, it's just applying to sort of councillors, yeah. Because staff are covered by employment agreements and that sort of thing instead. It's a little bit different for councillors.
So this legal action he's taking, that's not by virtue of him being a councillor that he gets to inquire against council power. This is just by virtue of him being a citizen, a New Zealander.
That's correct. We can all take actions of judicial review if we are affected by public power, if all sorts of things that happen in government or public bodies make decisions about our lives that we don't think are particularly fair. It's not about whether or not they're right or wrong. As you mentioned, we're not considering whether or not the parking ticket was valid or invalid. Instead, it's about the process that led to a particular decision being made. If we don't think that's particularly fair, or we think it's illegal, or we think it's unreasonable, then we have the opportunity to take it to the court and get a court to have a look at the process that was followed that led to the decision to determine whether or not it was legal, to determine whether or not it was fair. It's not an easy process to do this, and it's certainly not a cheap one, especially when you retain a QC to do that and then go to the Court of Appeal. This $12 packet parking ticket will have morphed into many, many, many thousands of dollars of legal fees. But constitutionally, it's a really important check and balance on the exercise of public power. So it's a good procedure to have.
It's a good procedure. It's not a common one, is it? This type of thing does not get taken to judicial review every day.
Parking tickets.
Something so, I mean, it's Lee Vandevis is perhaps not as, he's not accessing the legal system as readily as perhaps any other person would do.
Access to justice is a bit of a problem in this area because it is so expensive. You're right that judicial review and judicial review applications are rare in the grand scheme of things, though they are a pretty common procedure in front of the court. And often when you have decisions that are affecting people with deeper pockets, for example, you'll see judicial review actions being taken pretty frequently. I guess in Mr. Vandevis's defence, he's arguing for a broader and bigger principle, which is this all occurred in the lead-up to the local government elections of 2019, and he is of the opinion that this whole incident probably affected the way that voters saw him and affected the election. And he is of the view that essentially the process that led to his censure was potentially politically motivated, potentially unfair, and so he's essentially trying to sort of vindicate that process being being a fair one, being overseen in an appropriate way. So he's fighting for a broader principle in that regard, and so there's some sympathy, I guess, for that particular perspective. He got pretty sort of destroyed in the High Court, though. The judge there really didn't take any of his arguments very seriously, and so it'll be very interesting to see how the Court of Appeal deals with it.
Circling back to what you mentioned about, this was in the lead up to the 2019 local body elections, and so close even, I think it was a few weeks out, and he was concerned that the press that went on from that point negatively affected his chance at the mayoralty. He came very close second to Mayor Aaron Hawkins.
Did.
So is the court going to be asked to comment on the political matter here, whether it did negatively affect his chances at the mayoralty?
Not really relevant, I don't think. The idea that there was some sort of political motivation is only relevant to the extent that it might have affected the process. But the problem is that there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that, for example, the DCC sort of provided sort of information to media about this, didn't particularly sort of comment. It's unclear as to exactly how the DCC itself was responsible for the political outcry or sort of the fallout over this particular incident. The ODT reported upon it and did so fairly sort of independently of any sort of DCC engagement. So it's unclear as to exactly how that political effect would have occurred or whether or not it was politically motivated. I mean, ultimately, it was him that laid the first complaint in terms of sort of the staff members' response to his laying of the complaint about the parking ticket, and he didn't have to contest the parking ticket. I mean, it's there is a little bit of sort of self-responsibility here.
So if this court does go the other way and they say, no, there has been a legitimate misuse of public power or something went awry in the investigation of this complaint and it shouldn't have been, the censure that he received shouldn't have been given in the first place, what happens to Van der Vis?
If the court agrees, sorry, with...
They say, yes, this is I grant this judicial review, what happens then?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, funnily enough, the parking ticket doesn't go away.
Wow.
So instead, what would occur is that the censure that was the result of the investigation and the process that he's complaining about would likely be reversed. So the censure would be removed and absolutely nothing of any sort of consequence would occur otherwise. I mean, it's the whole point of judicial review is not to try and change a particular decision or focus on the outcome that you disagree with. It's not an appeal against a particular decision. Instead, it's inquiring about that process. And so what might occur is that the court might say, like, this process was a bit unfair, you need to go and do it again. Or we think it's so unfair and so sort of inconsequential in the grand scheme of things that we're reversing the decision and it doesn't need to be taken again because there's just no just no point. But the court will be saying to the DCC, essentially, you were exercising public power, you didn't exercise it particularly fairly, go and do it again, do it fairly this time. That's all he's really looking for.
So he's not going to recoup any of those legal costs that he sunk into this process?
Well, he will get some costs. If he won in the Court of Appeal, the way that it works is that a court can award costs against an unsuccessful party. So the DCC lost and Van der Vis wins, then he'll get some of his costs recouped. But not necessarily the costs in the High Court. Not the costs in the High Court. And certainly it won't be his full amount. He will have sunk a lot of money into this that he won't see again, even if he's successful.
Thank you, Marcelo.
My pleasure.
Kia ora, Bonnie. Next up, we have news reporter Sinona Bourne, who spoke with biochemistry and infectious diseases professor Kurt Krauss. You're listening to R1 News.
The National Institute of Health has just launched a phase 1 clinical trial evaluating 3 experimental HIV vaccines based on messenger RNA technology. The new HIV vaccine is set to follow the same guidelines and science as the COVID-19 vaccine. We are joined by Professor Kurt Krauss, a virologist at University of Otago, who is currently looking into HIV research. We know this new technology as what's used in the COVID Pfizer vaccine. Can you explain to us what messenger RNA technology means?
Yes, so messenger. So, what's going on? The bottom line is that scientists are trying to develop a vaccine to prevent HIV. And it's probably good to mention that this has been a big problem for a long time, and back before I came to New Zealand, I was a practicing ID doctor in America, and my main patients were HIV patients. And we went through this period where HIV was this huge pandemic, and we were thinking, okay, can we treat this with vaccines or can we treat it with antivirals? Make a long story short, the vaccine stuff just didn't work out, and we can talk about why that is. But one thing, so fast forward to the present, is vaccine technologies have been updated significantly since back. That was really in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things that have happened is the idea of using mRNA for a vaccine. So a vaccine is really kind of a way to train your immune system to fight a virus. And you do the training by giving it either the whole virus that has been inactivated, or you give it pieces of the virus. And then you inject these proteins or elements of the virus into the person's body who you're trying to protect. And then the immune system goes, I don't recognize that. I'm going to make an antibody against it. Or I'm going to actually train a T cell to go after any cell that's making that bit there. I don't like that bit. But you do it in a controlled way. So if somebody encounters the whole virus, they're trying to teach their immune system to fight it while the virus is attacking. So the vaccine gives it to the person in little bits that aren't dangerous, and we train our immune system to be able to recognize and attack. So it's cool. So one way to do that is you make up a whole bunch of protein bits, because viruses are sort of protein-coded bits of nucleic acid, and you take the protein bits and inject them in people, and we make antibodies against them. Another way to do it is you take a step back, because when the body makes proteins, they make proteins that are coded for by a kind of long chain of nucleic acid called mRNA. And the mRNA is read by the ribosome to make proteins. So RNA vaccines, simply stated, are a long stretch of RNA that can be given in an injection to a person, and the cells that it enters make that protein, make the foreign protein, and process it in a way that it gets exposed to immune cells, and then immune cells react to it and become able to recognize it and attack it and protect the body from it, and then you're vaccinated. Then the vaccine works. So historically, RNA vaccines weren't really used. They're being used more and more now, and there's a huge advantage because you're able to design things quicker and make changes more easier and make adjustments more easier. So in a nutshell, that's one of the – I'd say there's two key breakthroughs in this vaccine. One of them is using the mRNA.
Awesome. And you said before that it's been quite a scientific challenge for many to make a therapy for HIV. With this new approach, do you think it's going to be more expensive and more accessible, or do you think it's going to be hard to become like accessible to all patients with HIV?
I think the mRNA, once they find a safe and effective mRNA vaccine, it becomes more accessible because it's easier to manufacture, it's easier to transport, it's easier to make adjustments and changes. So that's going to be a good thing. That's going to be a really good thing. Okay, so I mentioned that when you train the body to develop antibodies and immune reactions in vaccination, you need to give the body a little piece of the virus, an inactivated piece, a broken off piece, right? And then the body goes, yeah, okay, I'm gonna recognize that. The problem with HIV has been that when the scientists make those little pieces, they don't hold together well. They actually fall apart. They don't. The conformation is wrong. It's not stable. It's been a real quagmire to engineer the particle properly.
Yeah.
So the big breakthrough is there's now – so HIV, kind of like the coronavirus, you've heard about spike protein in coronavirus, right? And the spike protein is the main component of all these different vaccines. So HIV has something like a spike protein. It's called ENV. That ENV is composed of protein and sugar molecules that are attached to the protein, and it's called GP160. And it's a big thing. It's 160,000 molecular weight, and it's got a few different pieces. So those pieces, if you just give them separately, they don't hold together well. But scientists at NIH have been able to engineer a version of this glycosylated protein that hangs together, and it forms the kind of a cluster that naturally happens in the vaccine. So it's kind of an engineered form that is very stable. And this relates to what happened with the coronavirus, because the coronavirus vaccine, same problem. These spike proteins, it's amazing. Honestly, to tell you the truth, I've been working with viral proteins for decades, and they are so hard to work with. They are not friendly proteins. And as a result, I'm always amazed that viruses even work. It's like, man, your proteins don't even work. How can you infect us? Because your proteins are falling apart. They're not stable. So the natural proteins and viruses are very difficult. But the scientists at NIH stabilized the protein, and the scientists who were doing coronavirus research stabilized the spike protein. And the same kind of tools were used to make a happier, more stable spike protein. And that's gone into the vaccine development. So we've got more stable proteins in a more native formation, a proper formation delivered via this mRNA. And it looks good. It's exciting development, but it's only phase one.
Yes. So for people that aren't sure of the stages of a vaccine process, how long would it stay in phase one before, say, it gets to commercial use?
Can be a long time. So the phases are phase one, two, three, and four. And the three phases before the drug or the vaccine is introduced are phases one, two, and three. So phase one is going to be done, and no one expects there to be a problem, and we'll hopefully find out that it's very safe and there's some evidence of efficacy. Then it gets ramped up to phase two, where you're talking about giving it to hundreds of people. And in phase two, you're beginning to look at dosages and efficacy, like how much vaccine do you have to give, and how, and do you get a good response? And there'll be a few different doses tried, and maybe some different formulations tried. Like in this phase one, there's three different formulations being tried. Then if that works well, then you go to phase three. In phase three, you're giving it usually to many thousands of people. So for coronavirus, it would have been in the tens of thousands of people. And then you're trying to get a careful view of safety and efficacy. But I'd expect the phase one will happen this year, and they'll be analyzed, and we'll be looking into going into phase two, either maybe early next year or later next year, depending what the funding situation. And yeah, there's such a need. If things look good, that yeah, it'll get pushed ahead. But boy, there's been a list of spectacular failures in the HIV vaccine area, so it's a tough area.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Kurt.
My pleasure. It was really good to talk to you.
That was Professor Kurt Krause on the RNA technology going into phase one trials in the US, aiming to be the next therapy to target HIV. You're listening to R1 News. Stay tuned.
Kia ora everyone, and it is 4 minutes past 12 here on Thursday. You have been listening to myself, Korsanena Aho.
Of course, Scott Aho. R1 News will be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. sharp.
Coming up for music, we have Miley Cyrus with Heart of Glass, and this is a Blondie cover. Have a great day.
for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There are heaps more at r1.co.nz.